You're getting a view into the locker room that you don't normally see.
A sanitized view.
Not a natural scorer.
The honest opinion, he's not doing the job that they hired him to do.
I just disagree.
Accelerating your hockey learning curve. This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290. TSN1290.ca.
For the thousands in attendance and the millions watching around the world, ladies and gentlemen, let's get ready to rumble!
In this corner, weighing in at 205 pounds, looking terrific this morning, 9 a.m., May 2nd, from the Pemina Studios, is Ezzy Ginsberg. Richard Pollock. Ezra Ginsberg, it's the two of us this morning on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Of course, Manny Pacquiao and Floyd Mayweather are garnering a lot of the attention, but we have 3 hours of hockey talk for you on this Saturday morning. Denny Potvin, legendary Islanders defenseman, is going to join us later on in the show to talk about the Islanders moving off of the island to Brooklyn, the Florida Panthers season as a whole, and of course, him being a resident of Ottawa and covering the Senators last year, talk about the great season in Ottawa. Ted Kaufman of the Detroit News is going to join us to talk about the Red Wings season, but more so, Ezzy, what's happening with Mike Babcock, because that's really getting all the attention right now in Detroit. And if you follow the WHL, and even if you don't, Bruce Lubke, Brandon Wheatkings, play-by-play guy, is going to join us to talk about the Wheatkings being the Eastern Conference champions in the WHL and awaiting the winner of Kelowna, and I'm forgetting who Kelowna's playing, Ezzy. Kelowna, I think it's going to be Kelowna, and I'll remember that. In the final of the WHL, Wheatkings taking apart the Calgary Hitmen last night. Close game after one period, but after that it was done, and the Wheatkings are just on a roll right now. So, before we talk about all those things and talk to those guests, Ezzy, I want to talk to you, and the listeners, of course, about the Winnipeg Jets. Nearest and dearest to our listeners' hearts, most of all. And kind of the topic of conversation as this week is, it has led people to the unrestricted free agents that the Jets have. That means players that can be signed as of July 1 by any other team in the league for no compensation aside from money. Meaning they don't have to make a trade, they don't have to give up a draft pick. And the Jets have more than a few of these UFAs. And the topic of conversation, there was a poll on IllegalCurve.com that Dave Manuk posted asking listeners, and readers, excuse me, or both, who they would bring back. And the ones I want to talk about in this segment are Michael Frolik, Drew Stafford, Lee Stempniak, and Yuri Tulusti. And I can tell you the readers on IllegalCurve.com voted for Drew Stafford for the one UFA they'd want back more than others. Where do you stand on this, Ezzy? And I'm going to ask you a two-part question. Who do you think the Jets should bring back? And we'll talk about money in a little bit. And who do you think they should bring back? And who do you think they will bring back?
Richie, it was the Portland Winterhawks who the Kelowna Rockets are playing in the Western Final. So the Brandon Wheatkings will play the winner of that series. Kelowna's up 3-2 right now. To me, this is going to be the debate, Richie, that we have leading up until the draft and heading into free agency. And, you know, you mentioned Drew Stafford, and to me, out of all of the free agents, especially the forwards, to me, Drew Stafford is the one that really, I think, should be the key free agent signing for Kevin Cheveldayoff. Not to say that Michael Frolik hasn't been an impactful player and hasn't been a versatile player, but to me, Drew Stafford, since he arrived, and, you know, we could list off his statistics, and they were very good playing with Blake Wheeler and Mark Scheifele on the second line there. His impact was really felt, and he's a bona fide top six player. And to me, he has higher upside offensively than Michael Frolik. I think Michael Frolik, you might give him a slight edge defensively, but Drew Stafford's a very responsible defensive player as well. So to me, you look at the free agents, and you know, we mentioned Stafford and Frolik, and you've got Tulusti and Stempniak. Stafford and Tulusti and more so for Leak and Stempniak, I think all of them, I would say, it's going to come down to the term and how much money they want. And I think, you know, everyone seems to think that the number for Frolik and Stafford is going to be similar. I believe Stafford made $4 million last year, and Frolik was at 3.5. I think you could say that they both would probably seek a raise, Richie, and they'd probably want in the $4 to $5 million range. We could speculate that it would be even on the high end, $5 million a year. So based on that, and based on the fact that Dustin Byfuglien and Andrew Ladd's contracts are up at the end of the year, and they're probably next year, that is, and they're probably going to want in the range of $6 to $7 million.
Mm-hmm.
It's tough to say exactly because, again, it's dependent on the term. You got to think that one of those players, Michael Frolik or Drew Stafford, isn't coming back. And to me, because Michael Frolik signed the one-year contract, I think that, you know, that is a little bit of an indication that he won't be coming back. I think his agent, Alan Walsh, had the opportunity to sign, we're told, a 3-4 year deal with the Winnipeg Jets and didn't sign. And to me, I believe, in a way, Michael Frolik is more replaceable than Drew Stafford. And what I mean by that is I think that next year you're going to see the Jets give a good opportunity for several youngsters to make the team. So you're talking about Andrew Kopp, you're talking about Nikolai Ehlers, you're talking about Josh Morrissey on the back end. And to me, you can sign someone a little bit cheaper on the free agent market. So, I mean, again, you know, this year's free agent market isn't the best it's ever been.
It's not a good one, yeah.
And Michael Frolik and Drew Stafford are probably at the top of that list as far as highly sought-after free agents. So, you know, you're talking about Mike Green. You're talking about Matt Bolesky, who I think the Ducks are going to try to re-sign, playing left wing on the second line there for the Ducks. But to me, Richie, it's Drew Stafford. I think he's a very intelligent player. You know, he's not going to score 40 goals and 80 points, but, you know, he's going to give you a solid 20 goals, 50 points. And he really worked well with Mark Scheifele, I thought. I thought he was a really kind of a calming influence, and they really fed off of each other. So, again, nothing to take away from Michael Frolik, but I think if you're picking between those two players, I think you go with Drew Stafford. And plus, he's from Wisconsin.
Yeah.
He's comfortable with a lot of guys on the team that are from Michigan and Minnesota. And I really think he liked playing here. I truly got that impression from him and from what he said to the media. He really liked playing here. So to me, again, this is my own personal opinion. I have no inside information here.
Yep.
I think that Drew Stafford, to me, makes more sense to sign him. And if we're throwing out numbers, yeah, give him $4.5 million a year for 4 years, something like that.
That's exactly what I think it'll probably cost, Ezzy. And I want to just quickly go over, you know, some details about these two players. And we're talking about Stafford and Frolik in the sense that they really can only pick one. I mean, sure, they could sign both now, but then next, you know, the cap is probably going to be $69-70 million this year because of the Canadian dollar. And then you look at next year, well, you have to sign Trouba, you have to sign Scheifele, you have to sign Lowry, and then you're going to have the Ladd and Byfuglien contract extensions kick in if they're still here, or alternatively, the contracts they acquire, presuming that there are some NHL contracts they acquire in exchange for those players. So to lock up, say, $8-9 million in Stafford and Frolik, is probably, with the young players you mentioned are coming in, is probably unlikely. So if you compare Stafford to Frolik, I mean, they're different players for sure. If you want to look at offensive output, Stafford's career high in goals was 31, Ezzy, and he scored that in 2010-11. He's actually scored that in only 62 games, but that's also, it's been a few years since then. You kind of talk about the 20-goal mark. That seems to be a reasonable benchmark for what Drew Stafford. He scored 18 goals this year in 76 games. You look at Michael Frolik, scored 19 goals this year in 82 games. He had 21 goals in his first two seasons in the National Hockey League, then kind of tapered off. So we know that Frolik's a little bit more of an all-around player, not as dynamic offensively, I don't think. But you probably know what you're getting more often from him than you do Drew Stafford.
And again, I don't want to take anything away from Michael Frolik because I do think he's been good over the last couple of years for the Winnipeg Jets. But to me, if you're comparing, and you're right, Michael Frolik, a little bit more of a penalty-killing specialist, a little bit more of a defensive type of forward. But to me, on a night-in, night-out basis, Drew Stafford, you know what you're going to get a little bit more. Michael Frolik went through spurts of this year, he was invisible. Yeah. And I think I remember you talked about this, Richie, during the Jets-Ducks series. You know, Michael Frolik playing with Andrew Ladd and Brian Little, he's not the type of player that can carry a line. I think Drew Stafford at times can carry a line. On the Wheeler line, Wheeler's carrying the line with his speed and size. But also, Drew Stafford, I think, is able to create more offensively. And I think that's what this team needs. I think there are players on this team that are good defensively. Scheifele's developed his defensive side of his game. You know, it's obviously a work in progress.
He's got to get stronger on the boards.
He's got to get stronger, and he still hasn't, especially going up against Ryan Kesler in the first two games. But I think, you know, Rich, you mentioned you can't be paying your fifth and sixth forwards each $4.5-5 million a year. They're going to have to make that determination. And next year, it's possible that they might have to move someone up or move Matthew Perreault to a different position than he was last year. That's kind of what it created a good problem. Drew Stafford coming in created a good problem. They could have Matthew Perreault on the third line playing left wing with Adam Lowry. Ideally, you don't want to move him to the right wing. That's a little bit of a problem to me. If Michael Frolik isn't re-signed, you have a bit of a hole there on the right wing. And that's something you either have to address with a rookie.
Ehlers plays right wing, though. Oh, no, he's on the off wing, if I recall correctly.
He does. He plays both.
Yeah.
He plays left wing and right wing.
I see.
But do you want to put him on the second line? To me, you ease him in on the third line, most likely.
Maybe.
But
I see him being an off wing player just based on his style, but I certainly could be wrong about that. But I want another thing is Frolik is 3 years younger than Stafford.
Yep.
And about Frolik, I mean, look at the past 2 years. His only two seasons in Winnipeg, 42 points in both seasons in 81 and 82 games, respectively. So, I mean, you know what you're getting.
And Frolik, again, he's very versatile. He's played on the first line. He's played on the second line. He's played on the third line. And he's done a lot for this team. He's been relatively healthy. But to me, he's going to ask for a little bit too much money. And he's got a Stanley Cup. And he was good with Chicago. And, you know, he came into the league. He was good with the Panthers. But it's going to ultimately come down to the decision. And, I mean, maybe they try to sign these two guys. I don't think it's going to happen. I think it's highly unlikely that Michael Frolik's going to come back. I've said that time and time again, and that's just basically my perception of the situation.
Well, wouldn't it have happened by now? It's like Babcock. I mean, we'll talk about Babcock later, but wouldn't he have signed with the Red Wings by now? Frolik's been here for two seasons. He knows what comes with playing in Winnipeg. He knows Adrian Allen Walsh is a difficult negotiator, whatever. I mean, and still, at the end of the day, Walsh takes instructions from his client, and I'm assuming the Jets were probably willing to offer 3 or 4 years before, and I think you're going to get into a number that you might be uncomfortable with. I mean, if you say $4.5 million for 4 years for both players, you're telling me you take Stafford still.
Yeah, absolutely, Richie. And now Frolik's position is stronger. So now he's not RFA, he's a UFA. That's because he signed the one-year deal. So now he's in a better position. He can say, well, there's a lot of teams that are looking for someone like me, a veteran who's got the Stanley Cup, who can play on a team's second-line wing, maybe third line. He's got the penalty kill prowess. Like, to me, throwing out a team, Pittsburgh. To me, a Michael Frolik would fit in perfectly with a Pittsburgh or a Detroit. I mean, there's a lot of teams that I don't think Frolik's going to have a problem signing with a team.
Expectations will be interesting for him, though, because he is here as a third-line right winger who's able to move around the lineup, as you mentioned. But when you're expected to be a third-line right winger with, bonus play up top, it's different than signing for big money in the offseason and a team expecting you to play second-line right wing.
Yeah, absolutely. And Frolik, I think, is better suited on a better team. He's a third-liner, like on Chicago.
Absolutely.
Chicago, he wasn't a top six
guy. Fourth-liner in Chicago.
Yeah, he was a fourth-liner. Yeah. Exactly. And I think on the Jets, he's at times plays on the first line because they don't have the depth that certain teams like Chicago and the LAs and other teams in the past have had. It's interesting, but to me that's the key there. And kind of, my gut and heart tells me that Drew Stafford's going to sign. I felt like out of all the players that came in, both of them were in the Kane trade. I thought Drew Stafford and Tyler Myers came in, and it's almost like it was seamless how they fit into the team.
Does he play left or right wing if they re-sign him, though? Because he succeeded on the left side, really, for the first time in his career, as far as I'm aware. He's always played right wing. At UND, he was right wing. In Buffalo, he was right wing. He seemed to fit in beside Wheeler and Scheifele on the left wing before they made the switch in Game 4. I mean, that's interesting, because the Jets do have a left wing hole with Evander Kane now having been traded.
There's the hole there, but then if you move... there was already the hole with Kane, but if you don't re-sign Frolik, then maybe you move Stafford to play the right side on the top line, and then you have Wheeler with Scheifele, and then it's...
I thought that Stafford acquitted himself better on the left side than Frolik did. Frolik has played on the left side for small periods of time and hasn't succeeded, and center even for small periods of time. Maybe that flexibility and the Jets' belief that he can play both sides, and you mentioned Ehlers too, will give him a little bit more of an edge in terms of their wanting to sign him. I don't know, but it's an interesting conversation. We're going to go to break. We didn't even get to Stepniak and Tulusti, so we're going to start that on the other side of this, Ezzy. And then we also want to get to Jim Slater, Matt Hawaschuk, and a couple other Jets free agents. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show live on TSN 1290. +9:20 on Saturday morning, May 2nd. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. If you missed the first segment, we were talking about Jets free agents pending UFAs, specifically the Drew Stafford-Michael Frolik debate, which we wanted to talk about for about half the segment and got into it and spoke about it for the entire segment. That's the beauty of this show, of course, and it's Richard Pollock being joined in studio by Ezra Ginsberg. Drew is off on holidays for this week, actually, and next week. What a shame. Yuri Tulusti, Ezzy.
Not really a shame.
And that's why, yeah. Hopefully people could tell from my tone. Yuri Tulusti and Lee Stepniak, Ezzy, are two guys that the Jets brought in at the deadline, or Tulusti just prior to the deadline, and Lee Stepniak on deadline day. Two guys who are both UFAs. Lee Stepniak, we know the Jets tried to sign last offseason. Ken Wiebe, the Winnipeg Sun, talked about this, and he had opted to sign with the Rangers, the New York Rangers, who are, of course, playing in the second round right now, thinking they had a better chance at the Cup, which I think was an accurate read. Anyhow, both came to Winnipeg, and I think to certainly had different success levels. Stepniak seemed to fit in pretty well and put up some points and some goals. Tulusti was invisible, essentially, for his entire short period of time here in Winnipeg. What do you think happens with these two players? Both going to hit the market, we think. First off, which of the two would you bring back if you had to choose? And then the second part is, would you bring either of them back if in reality?
Yeah, I think you bring Stempniak back. I really like Lee Stempniak. Lee Stempniak, he played for Calgary, but he's been on seven teams. He's played on Toronto, St. Louis earlier in his career. To me, and Lee Stempniak, by the way, is the answer to the trivia question of who scored the first Jets 2.0 playoff goal at MTS Center, right? So Lee Stempniak, to me, Richie, is who you bring back out of the two. I remember we were talking about this on NHL Midweek. Yuri Tulusti, to me, is a good offensive player, but he needs to be with the right players, and Yuri Tulusti is ineffective in a bottom six role, to me. I mean, you look at Yuri Tulusti on Carolina, and before that he was drafted by Toronto, as you know, Richie. He played with Eric Staal and Jeff Skinner at times in Carolina, and that's when he had his big years. To me, he needs to have someone creating. He needs the puck, and he needs space out there. He's not a physical player.
To me,
Lee Stempniak, he's 32 years old, from New York. We know that Kevin Cheveldayoff talked about wanting to sign him last summer before he signed with the Rangers. So you know that Kevin Cheveldayoff likes Lee Stempniak. To me, he's a perfect veteran guy, an upgrade over some of the bottom six forwards they've had. He's a bona fide guy at this point in his career, 10 to 15 goals, 30 to 35 points, something like that. But he finishes his checks. He's responsible. And Lee Stempniak is one of those guys very good in the locker room, from what I've been told. Mm-hmm. He's one of those players that is very well liked and is the type of player that other players look up to because he's been around and in the NHL and all of that. So to me, Lee Stempniak is a guy that the Jets would probably I think it's obvious that they'd like to sign him. They traded for him. I thought that was a great trade too, Richie. Carl Klingberg wasn't working out. It's unfortunate because his brother John had a great season and signed the big deal with Dallas. But I think Lee Stempniak fits in perfectly for what the Jets are trying to do. And I don't know, I'm not saying that Yuri Tulusti, he's from Czech Republic and he had familiarity with Frolik and Pavlik. And I know that.
But we don't know if Frolik's coming back, right?
Exactly. Yeah. But to me, Lee Stempniak, out of those two guys, is someone who I think fits in. And, you sign him to a 1 or maybe a 2-year deal. I mean, at his age,
More than a 2-year
deal. You're not going to sign him to a 4-year deal or something like that. Right? But to me, he's a guy that if you need to put him on the third line, he can contribute, but most likely he's ideally a very solid fourth line guy for your team.
I would agree with that, Ez. Yeah, out of the two, I would select, I would choose Stempniak as well. If you always feel more comfortable on bottom six guys, especially if you want to play him on the fourth line, you want to have probably on a 1-year deal. I don't think it'd be the worst thing in the world to have him on a 2-year, $2 million or something around that, a little bit more maybe, deal. Is he? Because I do think he solidifies that spot. Now, of course, you talk about the young players the Jets have, but it's also a matter of being able to earn their keep and beat out veterans like Stempniak. He's kind of a quick player. He's got a good shot. There's nothing he does particularly well, well as compared to his NHL colleagues. But he's a pretty smart player, and you can use him in the third line role. Or the fourth line role. And if you want to get some offense from your fourth line, that'll certainly be helpful. And if the Jets are going to have the depth that you speak of, and you would expect them to have more depth with the young players coming through, then a guy like that still helps, right? I mean, you don't want to have all young guys on your bottom six. You want to have veterans around who know how to play in that role and have before. Tulusti, quickly, before you get in here, Ezzy, Tulusti to me, it just doesn't fit. I mean, you have Perreault now being a left winger, not a center. And you talk about having a hole in the top six if Stafford doesn't resign and Frolik won't play in the left side top six. So if you have Ladd, we'll see what happens with Ladd. You have Ladd and you have Perreault. You have a spot between them. Although theoretically, Perreault's top six left wing. So if you need a third line left wing, then Tulusti certainly doesn't fit. If you need a second line left wing, to me, Tulusti doesn't fit there either. So I think Tulusti's on the way out. And then Stempniak, could slide in on the right side on either the third and fourth lines and could make some sense. But you don't overpay for a guy like that. If the dollars make sense and, you know, you don't go over 2 years in term, then I think I would be comfortable with that.
Right. And for me, one of the keys that you just mentioned, Richie, is we expect Nikolai Ehlers and Andrew Kopp to be given a good chance to make this team. They haven't been penciled in. They haven't been given a spot, but there's a good chance that those two players specifically will be give, I believe, a better shot mm-hmm. to make the team over, say, others, Nick Petan, other players like that. Just talking about forwards. Sure. So I think Josh Morrissey is someone who has a good chance to make the NHL next year as well. But to me, if you're going to have those two players ideally in your bottom six, I don't think Andrew Kopp's starting the season as the first line center.
I don't know a lot about him, but I don't think he's starting any season as a top six
well,
center.
Well, exactly.
Is he?
But yeah. if they're being given a chance, because obviously, you know, that depends on Jim Slater, who we'll talk about next.
Yep.
If he's brought back as the fourth line center, but especially if you're going to have a Nikolai Ehlers on the third line left wing or right wing,
sure.
as we were talking about,
sure.
he can play both.
Sure.
If he's in the NHL and Paul Maurice asks him to play left wing over right wing, he'll play whatever is asked of him. I don't think that you want too much youth. And we already know the Jets are a young team. Scheifele and Lowry up the middle, 22, 21 mm-hmm. years old. So you got to have these veteran guys. And to me, that's why, you know, transitioning into Slater, I think Slater should be brought back. And I know a lot of people are kind of skeptical or questioning whether he'll be brought back. But to me, Jim Slater does all those little things right. He's a great penalty killer, a top face-off guy in the league. Mm-hmm. His offense, he's slowed down. There's no doubt about it. I'm a big Jim Slater fan, the GST and all that. He slowed down a little bit. Three or four years ago, he was able to put, you'd see Jim Slater, you'd burst down the wing, and he could provide a little bit more offense. He, at this point in his career, he's not going to provide that much offense, but to me, he's a specialist. He's a penalty-killing specialist. He's responsible. Teammates love him. I mean, remember Mark Scheifele, they were showing it on Korch's corner when Jim Slater was blocking a shot, and Scheifele went up to him and was patting him on the head. Like, he's one of those veteran leaders of this team. So to me, I think you do sign Jim Slater to a one-year deal, or, you know, hopefully for him, a two-year deal, and you bring him back, and then you let Andrew Kopp develop in the AHL, because he's never played any pro hockey. Yep. That's what I would do. And again, I'm not Mike Keane. I'm not Kevin Cheveldayoff. I'm not the ones that make the decisions. You know, I'm just the one that gets paid the big bucks to talk on the radio.
That's right. That's why we're asking. So, okay. So I think we kind of established the Toulouse Stemniak portion. If you look at the other free agents, and you got into Slater there, Ezzy. So I'll leave him be right now. Matt House, Chuck, TJ Gagliardi, Eric O'Dell are all UFAs, and then you have an RFA in Anthony Peluso. Is there any reason to bring, and with due respect, is there any reason to bring any of those guys back on anything other than two-way deals?
I think every single one of those guys should get a two-way deal. I think that most likely, Richie, no, they won't get a one-way deal. I think Anthony Peluso this year especially really struggled as opposed to last year. I thought he was a lot more effective.
He was the only one with a one-way deal out of those four last year.
Right. Yeah. And I think he signed a two-year deal originally,
yes.
if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, he did.
But you know, you've got Chris Thorburn who can drop the gloves and who plays that role on the team. And Anthony Peluso, for a lot of this season, you know, the first 50, 60 games of the season, was playing that kind of role with Chris Thorburn when Chris Thorburn especially moved up to the third line. But Anthony Peluso, you know, he ran into trouble with penalties. He took a lot of minor penalties mm-hmm. and he ran into trouble. And I think he lost a little bit of confidence in Paul Maurice. That's just, you know, from my take. And like Anthony Peluso, a really good fighter. And when he's most effective, he can't be playing 2 or 3 minutes a game. That's the problem. So to me, I don't think...
If the coach doesn't trust him, then he's not going to play more than that. And then it's, you know, catch 22, right?
Yeah. So I think for Peluso, it's probably a two-way deal. And guys like Halaschuk, I think, you know... Halaschuk is one of those guys to me, drafted by the Devils, and was it the Devils or Predators? I thought it was the Devils. Maybe it was the Predators. He's a guy that, you know, he just doesn't have those offensive totals. You know, he's a grinder. Matt Halaschuk, you look up grinder in the dictionary, you'll find that, and hopefully he can continue.
By the Devils, yeah.
Yeah, he can continue his pro career, but, you know, especially with other, that's the problem, right? When you get to that age, you're 26, 27, and you're getting pushed.
You might
pushed
be better
up by,
than the young player, but you're probably more expensive or just as expensive, and there's no payoff at the end for the team.
Right.
Right, and that's the key. There's no development
curve.
He'd be
a great guy to play for what we expect, the Moose, something like that, and maybe he gets called up, you know, but to me, at this point in his career, he's most likely going to be a guy that plays in the A.
Okay, so we look at all those guys. So you look at your lines then, Ezzy, quickly. Well, you know what? Why don't we talk about the lines on the other side of the break? Because how it would break down in terms of what you're seeing before we get to the defensemen, okay? Because you talk about those four guys, and I agree with your point, but then there has to be spots that are filled in terms of, you know, who's going to play on the fourth line right wing. And of course, only in Winnipeg and Edmonton and Calgary do we talk about these things, but people want to hear it, right? And people want to know. And it's already amazing to me that we're in May and the training camp's in September, so it comes around quicker than you think. When we come back, we're going to talk about the Jets' lines and their free agent defensemen. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show live on TSN 1290. Halfway through the first hour of the Illegal Curve Hockey Show, just to note, 9 a.m. to 12 is going to be our new spring hours for May and June. However, Ezzy, who joins me in studio, Ezra Ginsberg, Sir Richard Pollock, and Drew Mandela is on holidays. Next week, we're on from 3 to 6. We're doing our show live from Canada Inns outside the Hockey Manitoba 100th Anniversary Dinner, which we're looking forward to very much.
Very pumped up about that. I saw some of the names that are going to be there. We talked about Mike Keane last segment. Of course, he'll be there. Reggie Leach from Riverton, of course.
Riverton Rifle.
Grew up with my dad in Flin Flon. I was talking to my dad about Reggie Leach. Hopefully, we can get Reggie Leach on.
Yeah.
We'll have to see about that. A lot of good names. Kerry Wilson. And names go on and on and on. So it's going to be tons of fun.
Dan O'Toole, I believe, is hosting that dinner. We're going to have him on as well. So we're looking forward to that. If you hear Dan and Jay's podcast, dude, that's always a hoot. We were talking before the break, you know, about free agents, who to bring back, all the UFAs. And then we said, you know, before we get to the D, why don't we go over the lines? Why don't we go over the forwards and see what's what? And you know, you write it down, Ezzy, and the Jets have five open spots. You have, I'm putting just, you know, for argument's sake, Ladd, Little, Wheeler back together on line one, okay? Line two, we got Perreault on the left side, Scheifele on the in the middle, and the open side on the right. Nobody on the right wing, okay? It's on the second line. Third line, you have Lowry at center. And nobody on his wings, because nobody's signed that we think will play there. And then the fourth line, you have Thorburn on the right side. You have nobody at center, and you have nobody at left wing. It doesn't mean that young guys can't take these spots, but that is, so you have five open spots to fill this offseason. Now, if you think that, if you think Ehlers takes one, and you think possibly Andrew Copp takes another, I don't know enough about either of those guys' games. I've seen Copp play for about 5 minutes, and Ehlers I've seen play think one or two games, and he's impressive for sure, but it's hard for me to speak about their games. But even so, you still have three spots. If you sign Stafford or Frolik, you still have two more spots you have to fill. So do you go outside the organization to fill those spots, or do you, you know, that's a lot of pressure on young guys, because remember how young Lowry and Scheifele are, and they certainly have played really well. But
so Richie, you mentioned that you got five spots there. To me, right off the bat, you fill three of those: Stafford, Stempniak, Slater. To me, I think we talked about it first segment. Drew Stafford's got to play a top six role, and Lee Stempniak, I think if you need to start him on the third line to start the season, you start him on the third line, and then hopefully other young players, as Mike Babcock, hopefully we can play that audio later in the show. Mike Babcock had an interesting comment to me about how Pavel Datsyuk and Henrik Zetterberg, when they were younger, pushed the older players.
They did.
And he was talking about how he needed that, more of that push. So he's talking about Thomas Tatar, Gustav Nyquist, Riley Sheahan.
It wasn't, if you're a Red Wings fan, it was a little bit disconcerting.
It was disconcerting, but he did mention that he hasn't made the decision yet. But I thought it was interesting how he was saying that they really needed that. And I think with the Jets, they're going to get that in the coming years with Nikolai Ehlers and I think Nick Batan down the road and others. Andrew Copp is a good young player. But to me, Richie, you got to pencil in Drew Stafford on the second line there, because he was excellent with Scheifele and Wheeler. And I think he plays really well with Mark Scheifele. And I wouldn't be shocked if they played again for the majority of next year. And you pencil in Lee Stempniak either on the third line or the fourth line wing. And then you put Jim Slater as your fourth line center. And now you've got two spots. And I think one of those is filled by probably Nikolai Ehlers.
Yeah.
Again, we've been careful on the show not to hype up prospects too much, but I think Nikolai Ehlers' skill level is the highest of any draft pick they've ever had. He's tearing up the QMJHL with the Halifax Mooseheads. I think, you know, he might have some struggles, but Richie, you look at some of the guys, smaller forwards, Johnny Gaudreau, Sam Bennett, for example, just to name two, and how they've done with Calgary. I don't think the Jets are afraid to put Nikolai Ehlers in that role.
Well, it's funny. Let me get on that. If you sign Stafford, Stempniak, and then say you bring Slater back, for example, and then you have Ehlers. So you have one more spot to fill, and that's a fourth line wing spot, and you can fill it with whoever you want, really. I mean, it's not going to be overly consequential, but it doesn't completely lack importance. Of course, every player on the team plays a role, as you saw in the playoffs, for sure. You look at the team up front though, and you think, okay, what about the physicality and the toughness that the Jets are trying to, you know, trying to make their identity? You know, that physical, hard skating, hard working team. And if you look at the players up front, after you tell me if that's possibly what they're going to have, I mean, they may not be as physical as they want to be. But you know, you can't always get what you want, right? As we played the Stones coming into this segment, and you know, you have limitations here, and you know, if you have Stafford and Perreault and Stempniak and Ehlers, and I know Ehlers can get into it a bit, and even Little, like, you don't have a ton of physicality, and I wonder if that, with the talent, they lose a little bit of that physical play, and which is fine at times, but also, I mean, how does that affect Paul Maurice and what he's trying to do? Just something to note. I think it's interesting, but Izzy, I think you're probably on the right track there with what they will do. And let's move to the defense because, well, you know, we've talked about Dustin Byfuglien, so we're not going to make this segment about Dustin Byfuglien. We're going to make this segment about the Jets' defense as, you know, as it relates to free agents. So RFAs they have who are restricted free agents who require compensation from another team if they're signed to an offer sheet. And they don't hit the open market, okay? So, or you have to trade for them and actually trade players or draft picks or whatever it may be. Ben Sherrod, Adam Pardy, Keaton Ellerbe, and Paul Postma. That's really it. I mean, you don't have many. You have Byfuglien with 1 year left, but you still have Byfuglien. You have Trouba with 1 year left on his entry-level deal. You have Enstrom signed long-term, which a fair amount of people are not very happy about. You have Stewart signed long-term, and you have Tyler Myers signed long-term. So there isn't much room to move here, you know, free agent-wise, unless there's going to be a trade. How do you see this all playing out, Izzy?
Well, to me, Ben Sherrod is pretty clear, Richie, that Ben Sherrod is an up-and-coming defenseman for this team, mm-hmm. and he played very well when he was called up from St. John's and played with Dustin Byfuglien, and then, you know, he was out of the lineup a little bit with an injury there and then came back, and I thought he struggled a little bit. But it's interesting, Ben Sherrod, he comes into the season still trying to prove himself to the Winnipeg Jets, and then establishes himself, pardon me, as an NHL defenseman. And in a way, he's kind of pushed a guy like Paul Postma out, because I think for the Jets, he's not someone who's going to tear it up offensively. I mean, Ben Sherrod, he's not going to score 15. He's not going to do that. He's got a decent shot, and he's got some offensive skills. But to me, he's very smart, responsible two-way defenseman. And you know, a lot of people will hear that, and they'll say, oh, okay, you know, that's boring, but to me, Mark Stewart doesn't play a boring game. Mark Stewart plays a very effective game. And at times, Mark Stewart was one of the best Jets' best defensemen, and paired up with Jacob Trouba was very solid. Sacrifices his body for the team and all that. So to me, Ben Sherrod is going to be a key for Kevin Cheveldayoff. And you got to think that he's going to want to lock him up for as long as he can, right? For a defenseman who was given a really good opportunity this year, you could argue that on other teams, he might not be given that opportunity because of injuries. So, you know, I'd love to see Ben Sherrod signed to more than a couple years, but I think ideally, Rich, that's what you're going to see, right? You're going to see them probably sign him to a couple years because he still isn't super established. He's had a nice year. What did he play, 40 or 50 games this year? He was a good, solid defenseman. So I think you're going to bring him back. And, you know, what does that mean for a guy like Josh Morrissey? Because Jay Harrison is your seventh defenseman.
What about Grant Clitsam? I didn't mention Grant Clitsam and Jay Harrison are both under contract next year.
And Grant Clitsam has, how many games has he played over the last 2 years? 30 or 40?
Well, I know. He's making $2.3 million.
It's a problem. To me, you know, that's almost a situation where you might want to move that contract.
Well, let's look. You're looking at seven contracts on the books next year without Sherrod on D. That's one-way deals.
Yep.
Are you signing somebody else?
You got to sign Sherrod.
Your other one-way deal. The other guys have to go then. Or at least signed two-way deals.
And again, I love Adam Pardy. But I really like Keaton Ellerbe too. I mean, but I think, you know, when
Keaton Ellerbe is, he's not smart enough to play, and he doesn't bring enough offense to play.
And also, you know, you just mentioned seven guys are under contract without Sherrod.
That's what I mean,
There's no more room. And well, Sherrod, Richie, you mentioned Sherrod for sure. A team will take Sherrod. You can't waive Sherrod, right? So, I mean, you got to sign Sherrod. That's eight. And then ideally, you want to have some type of room if Josh Morrissey has the ability to play.
23 man NHL roster, Izzy. Two goalies. If you have 8D, then you have 13 forwards. You have one extra forward to play. I mean, that's two extra D and one extra forward is kind of reverse of what you'd think, because there's 12 forwards and 6D, right? So you'd usually have 2-1 the other way.
It's a numbers game, right?
The other problem I think is, and if you sign Sherrod and you bring back the same D, is that D good enough?
I absolutely think it is.
And different. I think a different conversation. I'm not so sure it is.
As this year's D?
I'm not so sure the D is good enough to be where they want to go based on what they're getting paid.
Yeah, well, that's a whole different conversation, because I think we saw at times this year, and we've talked about this, on the right side with Trouba and Bufflin and Myers. The Jets are competitive with any. I mean, again, I don't think they have the best defense in the league, but as a whole, I think you could argue, especially when the Jets play at their A game, as Claude Noel used to say.
Yeah.
I think they've got a top 10 D in the league. Absolutely, that's the strength of this team.
If they're all playing, they do. Is I agree. It's just a matter of if they play enough defensive smart. Yeah. Offensively, they move the puck really nice. It's defensively, do they, especially in the playoffs? Do they, you know? And I know they played against a tough team, but do they engage enough?
Right.
Are they able to handle the physicality of the other team? And you think, oh, I mean, what do you mean? You know, Bufflin's physical, Stewart's physical, Trouba can be. Yeah, you know, Enstrom and Myers aren't the most physical, but Myers is probably the best defenseman in the first round.
Isn't that more reason to think, though, that a guy like Josh Morrissey, who's obviously playing he'll probably start in the AHL.
Well, I was just going to say, I mean, where does he fit in?
If Sherrod signs, you literally don't have a roster spot. As you mentioned, the 23-man roster.
Yeah.
NHL teams usually carry one defenseman, two forwards before the playoffs start, and then you're allowed to carry more players.
Whatever you want, yeah.
So, I mean, it's gonna push out. I don't think, unfortunately, guys like Paul Postma and Adam Party, they're probably not gonna fit in. And again, I love Adam Party. You know, he scored the big goal in game two, and Paul Maurice really liked him. But again, that Grant Clitson contract, that's another contract on the books that you probably don't want there. No offense to Grant Clitson, but I just don't think right now he fits into what the Jets are doing.
You don't. You're exactly right. And the question is, maybe, well, do you move Harrison or Clitson? If you do, you can't get anything for them, really. I mean, Harrison, you traded a sixth-round pick for, and they ate some contract. So you can eat some contract on that.
I think Jay Harrison is valuable, and he played well. He's a really responsible guy, and especially for the younger defenseman, Sherratt, Trouba.
And he's okay to be your extra guy.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, Clitson's obviously his back injury is another story, although he was skating by the end of the season, right? So that brings you back to Bufflin, probably. I don't think Trouba or Myers are probably, you know, aren't going anywhere. And the other issue is Morrissey's a left-side D. And that's really where their need is. But they have to sign Sherratt, and they already have Stewart and Enstrom under contract. I agree. I think Morrissey, and I think it's a good strategy to have Morrissey start in the A, or if he's that dominant in training camp, which is obviously a short amount of time, then you can make it better. You know, you have a luxury of making a seemingly difficult decision, which, if he plays that well, won't be as difficult, right? And there are always teams looking for defensemen. They just might not give you anything back for those defensemen. It's fun. It's fun to talk
about. Chevy's got a little work to do this summer.
Well, that's what's fun to be a... That's why they get paid the big bucks, right, Ezzy? Oh, after the break, we're going to talk about... He's back again. Alexander Burmistrov. I'm already been sick about talking with this guy for 4 years now.
Burmy's back. Burmy.
Apparently he is. And we're back after this. Burmy's back. Richard Pollock joined the studio by Ezra Ginsberg. Drew Mandel's on holidays, and we're talking about Alexander Burmistrov, who has yet again made his way into the news. A report from Igor Aranko on Twitter says, quote, Alex Burmistrov plans to return to the NHL and is not going to extend his contract in the KHL. With Kazan is the team he plays with in the KHL. So, that brings us back. Now, we talked about the open roster spot on the team if they sign some of these free agents in the possible fourth-line center open roster spot. Ezzy, does Burmistrov make his way into this? Because if I recall correctly, he had a huge issue with playing behind Olli Jokinen in year two, I believe, of the Jets' return to Winnipeg. And, you know, wasn't exactly the most well-liked guy in the locker room based on his attitude. You know, he did have some strong performances. He also, I thought, was a little bit overrated in his play. But he certainly is good enough to make the top 12 here.
I think he absolutely is, Richie.
But, Ezzy, I can ask you this. If he's not going to play ahead of Little or Scheifele, and if he's not going to play ahead of Little or Scheifele, and not ahead of Lowry, frankly, then, and I know Paul Maurice is coaching the KHL and all that, is he going to have any interest in coming back to Winnipeg and playing a fourth line role, center role, or a wing role, probably likely a third line wing role? I mean, right, if he had an issue a few years ago about playing that, and he's older now, and he, I would assume he thinks he's better, and probably is better. I haven't seen him play in a long time. what do you think happens?
Right. And I remember, Richie, about a couple months ago on NHL Midweek, we talked to Slava Malamud, who is, you know, on top of what's happening in the KHL. We actually had him on to talk about Ilya Kovalchuk possibly returning in the next 2 years to the New Jersey Devils or another team. And we asked him about Burmistrov. To me, it's fascinating because Burmistrov seems to elicit so much fan reaction, especially here in Winnipeg. You know, Dave Minuk of IllegalCurve.com posted this news and it got ridiculous hits and everybody was commenting on it. To me, this is a bargaining chip for Kevin Cheveldayoff. Alexander Burmistrov has played a couple years in Russia. He's put up some decent numbers. And again, we don't see a lot of these games in the KHL, but he's put up some decent numbers. I think wearing number 69, if I'm not mistaken.
You mentioned Kovalchuk there quickly. And if you saw Kovalchuk play in the Olympics, I mean, his pace was not close to what it was in the NHL. And I mean, to think he got better, he probably got better with age and probably got worse with quality of play.
Yeah, the players aren't as good in the KHL, but it's open ice and it's a different type of game. It's not that grinding North American style of game.
And he wasn't averse to contact, but I do think that his game would be well suited to a lot of open ice and curling around and he's kind of moving all over the offensive zone, not necessarily towards the net, but you know, moving around with the puck, right?
Richie, your question was where's Alexander Burmistrov going to slot on the team, mm-hmm. right? And to me, if the Jets are considering it, and more so if Alexander Burmistrov is serious about playing with the Jets, not just in the NHL, but with the Jets, he's going to have to accept whatever role is given to him. I mean, that's how it works. That's how it works in the NHL. You're not just given a spot. Unless you're Sidney Crosby or Wayne Gretzky, you're not just given a spot. You have to earn it. And I think Alexander Burmistrov clashed big time with Claude Noel. We all know that. And he was healthy, scratched, and all that. He wanted a larger role. But this is a Winnipeg Jets team who's on the up and up. They just made the playoffs.
Mm-hmm.
He's probably not good enough to be in the top six. So if he wants to play in the top three, well, Adam Lowry on the third line, has now earned that third line center spot. Alexander Burmistrov's not going to be the third line center of the Jets.
That's right.
So is he willing to play wing? I don't know if he was playing any wing for AK Bars Kazan in the KHL, but you know, would he play a fourth line role? For example, Vladislav Namestnikov on Tampa Bay right now, John Cooper has him playing on the fourth line mm-hmm. with Brendan Morrow. You do whatever is asked of you to be in the lineup. To me, Alexander Burmistrov would have to play that type of role. Maybe the fourth line, maybe the third line. But to me, again, back to the bargaining chip, Richie. Well, what could Alexander Burmistrov get from another team? You package Burmistrov with someone, you know, maybe that brings back a draft pick or a veteran forward.
Well, that's the thing. I don't think you're going to get what you're not going to get much for him, Ezzy. And I think you mentioned a good point. If you play him on the fourth, if he comes back and says, I'll play on the fourth line, I'll be a team player, and you sign him to a one-year deal, well, hell, he's going to put up 5 goals and 7 assists and have no bargaining chip and not have anything to lean on for his negotiation next year because he has no opportunity to score.
And the Jets have him under contract for, I believe, 3 more years.
Well, they have his rights. They don't have him under contract, but they
have his rights. Sorry, his rights. 3 more years, right? Because he's 23.
Yeah, I'd have to look up in the CBA in terms of how long they'd have his rights for.
Because it's 27 or 5 years in the NHL.
7 years in the NHL.
Oh, and he's played 3.
I think it's 25 or 7 years.
So he's got 4 till 27.
27 years, sorry, yeah.
So they have him. Yeah. So, I mean, if he wants to play in the NHL, he better kiss and make up with True North
or accept a trade. He'll accept the trade, I think. Yeah. I don't think that's a question. What do you get for him? I don't think you get anything more.
Get a second rounder for him?
Maximum. Maybe 2 years ago. I don't know if you get that for him anymore.
In this year's draft, I mean, maybe the Jets trade him for a second rounder at this year's draft.
I like your idea of packaging him with somebody.
Well,
you saw the Jets just do it with Kanan Bogosian.
To me, he's an interesting case because Burmistrov is an unknown at the NHL level at this point. The last we saw him in the lockout, he was inconsistent, and he, quite frankly, he wasn't being a team player.
What's his game? His game is he doesn't shoot at a 10. He skates pretty well. He's really strong on the puck, stronger than you think for a guy's size. Smart player, I think actually very good defensively for his age, at least he was a couple years ago. Certainly able to actually play the third line center role. I think probably quite effectively because he's pretty strong on the puck and he's aware defensively, doesn't really want to play that role. So I think he certainly brings qualities to the table. I'm not sure the qualities that he brings to the table are what he thinks he does. I mean, I think he thinks he's probably more of a scorer and he's probably more of a guy who's able to neutralize the other. You know, he's a little bit of Valtteri Filppula in him to me, a little bit.
But again, he hasn't proven it offensively. Right, because his last season, what did he have, 10 points, 12 points, or whatever it was during the lockout with the Jets? To me, I mean, Burmistrov might think he's Pavel Datsyuk, but he's nowhere near that.
He doesn't shoot the puck that well, and I don't know what he's done to improve that. But to me, his shot was an issue in the NHL. He wasn't able to get it. Wasn't quick enough. He didn't get it off quick enough, is what I'm trying to say there. And it wasn't dangerous enough in any event.
You made a good point, though, Rich. 23 years old, it's clear, right, that he wants to come back to the NHL. The Jets either want to make him a part of this team. Again, I don't know that.
Is this money-driven, by the way? I mean, the KHL, the money in the KHL isn't what it was a while ago. Well, these players aren't getting paid, some of them.
You're starting to see, I mean, Joachim Lindstrom signed with the Leafs. You saw Steve Moses sign with the Nashville Predators. You're seeing a lot of guys come over from the KHL now.
The Hawks just signed, that was Artem Panarin, I believe is how you pronounce it.
Yeah, and Leo Komarov came back and played for the Leafs. I mean, you're starting to see, I mean, there's going to be some teams that we're told are going to fold in the KHL, right? So you're starting to see guys come over. And I think, Rich, that's a good point. I think that if you're the Jets, though, and to back to your point, you want to deal with this now because you don't want to have a situation where his trade value decreases, right? And it looks like if he wants to play in the NHL, again, it's going to be with the Jets or without the Jets because they have his rights.
And then that's the thing to me is he's going to come back. If he's going to come back, it's going to be on the Jets' terms, understandably so, as far as I'm concerned. And if he's not willing to do that, then he's not going to come back. And they're going to trade him. The truth is the Jets, I don't think, have plans for him. So they've been making I'm assuming when the Jets are sitting there in their war room and they have all their players and all that, they don't really include him.
They have not been sitting around. And again, this is just our opinion. Because we haven't talked to Kevin Cheveldayoff about this, and he wouldn't tell us, quite frankly.
if he had coffee or horseshoes for breakfast.
They haven't been sitting around waiting for Alexander Burmistrov to make that decision. It hasn't been happening.
They're creating their spreadsheet. He's on sheet two.
Right, exactly. He's maybe if Burmy comes back. And again, I think that he creates an interesting situation because I think he could maybe carve a third line or fourth line role out for himself. But who knows? Does True North want him back? Do the Jets want him back? Does he want to play for the Jets? The big key to me, Rich, is the difference in, a different coach. Claude Noel, Paul Maurice, it's a different coach and maybe a fresh start for him.
That is a wild card. Yeah, that's a good point. And then that'll make it even more interesting to see what happens this season. I like the choice of music here by Chris. Doing a great job this morning on the Legal Curve Hockey Show. When we come back, going to start breaking down the second round series, and we have to give our predictions and recap our predictions from round one. See who did well, who didn't do well. First up, Capitals Rangers after the break. You're listening to the Legal Curve Hockey Show live on TSN 1290. Open up. The top of hour two on the Legal Curve Hockey Show, Saturday, May 2nd. Ezra Ginsberg in studio. I'm Richard Pollack. Drew Mandel is on holidays.
You're a bit of a raconteur.
Well played, Ezzy. Jack White here. First hour, if you missed it, talked all about the Jets. Free agents, UFAs, RFAs, forwards, defensemen. Didn't talk about goaltenders.
I feel like the Jets haven't played a game in like 3 months.
Isn't that weird?
It's been like a week and a half.
I know. I actually feel that way. Oh, God. It's unbelievable. This segment's brought to you by Not Auto Corp. Be sure to visit their beautiful new luxury auto and art gallery at the corner of Waverly and McGilvery. For more information, check them out online at www.notautocorp.com. Ezzy, we talked in the first hour about the Winnipeg Jets, but we're going to move it over to the playoffs. And before we get to Washington and the Rangers, I want to go over a little bit of the recap of the predictions from round one. Drew went 0-8, is that right?
It'd be pretty tough to go 0-8. I actually calculated what I went, and I was pretty happy to go 5-8. 5-4-8, I should say.
5-3.
5-3, yeah.
Which ones do you have wrong?
I got the Jets wrong. Okay. I took the Jets in 7.
Jets.
I took the Blues.
Blues.
I took the Islanders.
And
I didn't feel that bad about the Blues pick. The Blues really disappointed me. I think there's going to be some changes there. The Islanders, I mean, it came down to Game 7. So
they got absolutely annihilated in Game 7.
Well, I mean,
I know they lost 2-1.
No Hamonic, no Vyshnovsky, no DeHaan.
I know.
Three of their top defensemen are out, right? Yeah. I think Hamonic, if he's in that series, they win that series.
I think you're probably
not easily.
I think you're probably right about that.
But, I was giving you credit, Richie, off air before we started our previewing round two. And this Capitals team continues to impress me. Oh, yeah. I think you got to give a lot of credit to Barry Trotz. I got to give a lot of credit to Alexander Ovechkin, who I think finally has turned into a player that could take a team to the Stanley Cup. I really do. I think Adam Oates tried to do it. I think Dale Hunter tried to do it. Mm-hmm. I think Bruce Boudreau tried to do it. And I think Barry Trotz, because he's one of the greatest coaches of this era, you know, throw Mike Babcock in there as well. But I think this team is listening to Barry Trotz. They're following him. Yeah, Nicholas Backstrom's playing great. Like, this team looked good against the Rangers in game one.
Backstrom might be better than Ovechkin. Like, that's how good Backstrom is.
He's starting to shoot. Right, he doesn't shoot a lot. He's usually setting Ovechkin up, and he's been excellent. And he obviously had that hit on Dan Boyle that resulted in the Joel Ward goal.
Well, we'll talk about that in a second. So 5-3, we're gonna get our predictions at the end of each of these. We're gonna recap each series.
You know, I told you guys after we did those predictions, yeah. I wouldn't be surprised if I went 2-8. There's so much parity. I mean, it's tough. It's tough to go even 500. And so 5-3. What'd you go?
Well, Drew an 0-8.
Did he actually?
No, not actually. Oh. I don't even know what Drew went, but he's not here.
I don't remember Drew's predictions. I don't listen when Drew talks.
Drew's not here, so he's seemingly irrelevant. And if he was here, he'd be seemingly irrelevant. I went 7-1, Ezzy.
Really?
Yeah. You know, only series that got me this time was
7-1. Who are you, Zach Greinke?
I got lucky. You know, I mean, usually, I think last year I was awful. So, you know, broken clock is right twice a day. And only one that got me was the Senators. I thought they'd beat the
Habs. That was a bad pick.
Yeah, it wasn't a great pick, eh?
7-1, though.
Yeah.
You can't do much better than that. I guess you could go 8-0, but who goes 8-0 these days?
I'm going to go 1-4 now in the second round.
Yeah.
New York Rangers, Washington Capitals.
So we're watching this New York Rangers Capitals game on Thursday night.
Fantastic game.
Ezzy, a pretty predictable game, I'd say. I was saying to a friend off air this week,
was I that friend?
I don't think so. Yeah, you might have been there, but I don't think so. I think every game's going to be 2-1 in this series. I mean, because these teams don't create a lot of offense. I know, obviously, Ovechkin and Backstrom do, but the Rangers lose Zuccarello, and he's not going to play in the series, apparently. And these teams play both close to the vest. You have Holtby, and you have Lundqvist. I don't expect many goals in this series. And in the first game, 2-1, right? So I think the Rangers could play a heck of a lot better than they did in game one. I mean, some parts of that game, as you said, good game, and it was close game. And Ovechkin's goal was just incredible in the first goal of that game. But, I mean, if the Rangers are going to try and go to the Cup, which I think they're going to, you have to play a heck of a lot better than that.
Yeah, and to me, and I know you appreciate this to a certain degree, Richie, but everybody wants to see more goals. To me, what I'm looking for in the series, and to me, what's so fascinating about this series, is to see the top players create offense because there's just no room. The Rangers, have one of the best D groups in the NHL. They really do. And Kevin Klein is back. Mm-hmm. And I know maybe Dan Boyle didn't have his best game.
We'll talk about Dan Boyle in game one.
He didn't, but he's still a guy that, especially on the power play, you know, he's still an NHL defenseman. But in the Washington Capitals, I think this D group was a little bit underrated by me, especially Rich. And I think Brooks Orpik and Matt Niskanen, they've really done what they were supposed to do when they were signed, and that's provide them with kind of that defensive punishing playoff style of defense. And I think especially with you look at how the Capitals D is constructed, Rich, and Mike Green struggled when he was in a top four role.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now they got Mike Green on the third pairing there with Tim Gleason, and I really think that pairing has really worked for them. I don't think Mike Green excels when he plays 20 minutes a game and he has to face the opposing team's best players. I think Mike Green really excels in the role, and I think you got to give Barry Trotz credit. And I think, John Carlson and Carl Alsner, as we know, defensemen take a little bit of time to develop. And mm-hmm. I think you're starting to see this is the best I've ever seen John Carlson play. I think he struggled at times. He's kind of more of an offensive-minded defenseman. He was pinching in too much. But now he's kind of learned how to play that a little bit more of a defensive style.
I agree with you on that for sure.
And I think the Capitals aren't giving teams much. The New York Islanders, you talk about what they did against the New York Islanders. John Tavares, he got some points, but he wasn't a factor as much as I thought he'd be in that series.
That Game 7 was a clinic on how to – I know Franz Nielsen scored a weak goal on Holtby, but it was a clinic on how to play defense.
Yeah, give credit to Barry Trotz here. This Capitals team, we talked about this, Rich, for how many years? 2 years, 3 years, about how the Washington Capitals didn't really have an identity. Are they a team that basically just rides Alexander Ovechkin's 50 goals?
That's just it.
They have an identity now.
Exactly. Everybody knows their role on that team.
Yep, and putting Joel Ward on that first line, great decision. That what they've done, and I know I'm not the first to notice this, what they've done is they've put a physical forward on each line. So you've got Jason Chimera there playing with Kuznetsov.
I like Chimera.
And then you've got Troy Brouwer playing on that third line. And this team hits you. They're big.
I think they're the biggest.
Tom Wilson, that hit on Lubomir Vyshnovsky changed that series. It really did. And, Thomas Hickey was out there, and, nobody was could really respond physically to that. So you got to give these guys credit. I mean, this Capitals team, I'm picking the Capitals. I'll just tell you right now, I'm picking the Capitals in six. I haven't been as high on the Rangers all year.
To let the listeners know, sorry to interrupt, just to let the listeners know, we texted our picks to each other before the game started on second round.
Did you screenshot that, though?
I do have it here, so we're not
all
cheating.
All my picks are different?
Yeah, they're totally different.
Based on the first game. No, but let's be honest here. The New York Rangers, they're big guns, and especially their veteran big guns, Rick Nash, Martin St. Louis, they're not playing at the level they need to be right now. Like these, Rick Nash, had the 40-plus goal season this year. Where was he in game one? He wasn't a big factor in game one. He had a couple chances, but
yeah, I agree.
These guys have to be better, and the Rangers have a decent team. It's not like this. I mean, a lot of people were picking them to go to the Stanley Cup, but to me, I don't know if they keep the games close and all that. But they beat a Pittsburgh team that wasn't playing well at all, and they beat them in a way that wasn't convincing.
They didn't play that well. Yeah, I agree. You have the Caps in six, Ezzy?
Yeah.
And I have the Rangers in seven. But I want to talk...
After all that, yeah. Rangers in seven.
Well, I wouldn't be surprised. It's seven, Ezzy. So, I think it's very much a coin flip series. I think the Rangers just are a little bit deeper up front, and I think that'll be the difference.
See, I agree that they're deeper up front. But right now, like where they're at, especially against Pittsburgh, they're not.
You're right.
They're not producing at that level. For me, if the Rangers beat Pittsburgh in five games, and Rick Nash is scoring, and Brassard, and Stepan, and the big boys, and then you've got Kevin Hayes. Kevin Hayes had a really good regular season. He hasn't been very effective in the playoffs. Like, I haven't noticed him very much. These players.
I noticed him in game one. Like
Carl Hagelin. Got the goal in game one, and Zuccarello is injured right now.
That's a big loss for them. Out for the round, apparently.
Yep. So, who's going to score goals for this team? I mean, Holtby's...
But do they have to score more than three goals to win any game?
Everybody's talking about Lundqvist. I think Holtby is arguably has played better than Lundqvist.
Well, that goal by Jesper Fast hit two different... hit a leg and a stick, and it was lucky to go in with a very little time left in the game. Let's talk about the end of that game. Thursday night, 1-1, you're thinking, okay, we're going to overtime here, another overtime, kind of a low-scoring game. Puck goes into the offensive right corner, Dan Boyle goes to pin the puck against the boards with about 4 seconds left. Backstrom says, what the heck, there's 4 or 5 seconds left, goes and hits him. Dan, now, first of all, I'm going to finish talking about the play, then we're going to break that down. Backstrom hits him, Boyle goes down like a sack of hammers. Ovechkin comes, picks up the puck. As Don Cherry pointed out yesterday, two defensemen are in the corner. Derek Stepan leaves his guy in front. Who's his guy? The aforementioned Joel Ward only scores big goals, scores a goal with, 1 second left? Game over. And you're watching the game. You're like, what just happened? So first thing, what is Dan Boyle doing?
Dan Boyle, to me, I think what he's trying to do is he's trying to freeze the puck.
Yeah, I agree.
He's trying to freeze the puck, and he does it in a way. And Nicklas Backstrom is not known as the most physical
player. That's right.
But he'll lay a body check. And I think, that speaks to how Barry Trotz has this team playing right
now. Good point.
They have this team playing a very rough physical, not rough, but a physical style. Yeah. Get in on, create turnovers and all that. And it's going to cause the Rangers defense problems. And especially Dan Boyle is a smaller guy and he's lost a step. I don't think it's going to cause a problem for McDonough or the big boys like Girardi or Mark Stahl. But I think, on that goal, nobody thought that game wasn't going to overtime. And to me, Dan Boyle, it looked like he was a little bit shaken up on the play. And, because he's in the corner, Joel Ward's left out in front. As you mentioned, both defensemen went into the corner there, Richie. Give the Capitals credit. There's less than 5 seconds left, and they're trying to win the game.
Both defensemen are in the corner, but if you're Stepan and you see both defensemen in the corner, why are you chasing?
He's got to pick up Ward.
Ovechkin's not scoring from behind the net with three seconds left, especially not on Lundqvist.
That's a killer, Rich. And now they steal game one, so they've got home ice now, right?
I didn't think that was a penalty, by the way. I know lots of people. Vino went nuts, and I thought the Rangers writers said it was a penalty. First of all, I don't see a referee calling that play going to overtime to be 2 minutes off the top.
It's not a penalty.
I don't think it's a penalty.
It's boarding in the sense that his back is up against the boards, but he turns.
When you're playing hockey, at least years ago, you're taught to not ever put yourself in that position. He hugged the boards and put himself in that position. What do you want Backstrom to do?
And when you're in that position, too, you have to be ready and you brace yourself for the hit. Right? You have to be ready for it, and he wasn't ready for it.
At some point, the blame goes to the player.
I agree.
Not Backstrom here. He goes to the player, putting himself in that position. Dan Boyle made a stupid decision. He could have swung the puck around the boards or just tossed it into the corner. He could have curled with it and protected the puck. Instead, he tried to pin it with nobody on him right away, and Backstrom got a little headway. There you go. It's like Freddie Roach over here, is he?
More importantly, you know, you're taking the Rangers. I'm taking the Caps. What about Mayweather-Pacquiao? Who are we taking in that? We should probably save that till the end.
Should we? People don't actually care what we think about that, do they?
No, I just kind of cared what you...
Yeah,
you
well, I mean, everybody keeps telling me it's going to be Mayweather by decision after...
I hope Pacquiao knocks him out.
Yeah, that's what I'm going to predict.
I hope it goes...
Knock him out in round 10.
Yeah, I hope it goes a few rounds. I hope it doesn't end in the second round or third round or anything like that.
How many rounds are we going to have at your place tonight? Because you're hosting tonight.
Yeah, we're going to watch the fight. We're going to have the fight on, and I mean, it's going to be fun. I know, you know, these guys aren't in their primes anymore, but I think it's still going to be an awesome fight.
Yeah, I'm not going to be able to tell the difference anyway. Yeah. And, you know, speaking of fight, there wasn't much fight in the Calgary Flames on Thursday. Was it Thursday night?
Yep.
Yeah, it was Thursday night. That game was over after about 5 minutes. How did the Flames rebound, and what do we think of the Ducks, who are 5-0 so far in this playoffs? We'll talk about that after the break. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show live on TSN 1290. There we go. 10:15 Saturday morning, May 2nd. Richard Paul Gezer Ginsburg with you on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. The Flames and Ducks started off their series, their second round series on Thursday night, and it was a terrible game. And this game was brutal.
Well, this Anaheim Ducks team, Rich, we talked about it in the first round versus the Winnipeg Jets. This Ducks team has been underrated, I think, and underappreciated for how good it is. And, you know, Ryan Getzlaff and Corey Perry, when they're playing at their peak level, they can outplay anybody. I mean, and you talk about, you know, what these guys have done in the playoffs, you know, 2007 winning the Stanley Cup. In the Olympics, these guys were big parts of this team. Mm-hmm. I don't necessarily they didn't light it up. I mean, remember in the Olympics, all the games were, you know, pretty low scoring, and Crosby wasn't getting that many points. Getzlaff and Perry, they have the ability because they're big and they're skilled. They can take over the game. What did they each have? 4 points?
Yep.
So, I mean, the Calgary Flames, again, the Calgary Flames have been a great story. You know, they came back on Vancouver and won game six. This Ducks team right now, and I was a little bit worried about the Ducks because what did they have, a week off or so after the Jets series?
Yeah, well, they beat the Jets on Wednesdays, and they play Thursday at 8 days.
So, 8 days off.
Yeah.
And we saw last year the Montreal Canadiens had the long break after beating the Lightning. They were fine.
Yeah, they were fine.
So you think about the break, you know, it's almost like you rest the, you know, the bruises heal and, you know, all of that. And they didn't seem to miss a step. I mean, the Ducks, that was a statement. Like, that was a whooping.
Well, you know what that made me think of, Ezzy? Made me think of how much the Flames are going to miss Giordano in this series. Because Chris Russell is a real good defenseman. He's had a great year. He's not a big guy, and it's tough to defend against the big boys like Getzlaff and Perry, who use their body to create space. You know, the game slows down to their speed because they're so good. And you look at the Flames, I mean, their combos, you know, Brody and England or whatever it may be, can these guys, I mean, do they have anybody who's as good defensively all around as Giordano? No, they don't. And sure, you could say, okay.
Should have been nominated for the Norris, by the way.
Yeah, you know, you could say that. As you look at the end of the season, okay, they were able to succeed, and then they played Vancouver. But Vancouver, when you're playing against the Sedins as the top line, that's a possession line that's not as physical. Okay, they curl, they make plays, they're really, really talented. But when you look at Anaheim, they play off the cycle in a different way, in a physical way, and they go to the net, and Perry's presence in front of the net, and Getzlaff on the half boards there. Different game. And they're so big. And you saw when Corey Perry went in on Tobias Enstrom in the zone, he would go, flick, see ya, get out of here. And do they have a guy to be able to defend that? And that's the thing I look at, and I just don't know. And that line is that good. I mean, we both had, you know, we exchanged our predictions. We both had Ducks in six. I think the Flames will play better, than certainly better than they did in game one. And they need better goaltending. But how do they defend that top line is if I'm a Flames fan, I'm just happy to be there probably, but I'm concerned about that.
If game one is in any indication, the Ducks, the series might be over in four. And again, I'm pulling for the Calgary Flames here. I mean, the Western Canadian team, like, I want this to be a good series. But, you know, you mentioned Getzlaff and Perry, and they were excellent versus the Jets, mm-hmm. and so was Ryan Kesler. To me, it always comes back to depth. And to me, the Anaheim Ducks' depth is tremendous. Matt Bolesky got a goal. He got the first goal in game one. And you talk about Emerson Edom. Then Jakob Silverberg was excellent against the Jets. I mean, Cogliano. Yeah. I mean, this is a very deep team. And I think, you know, a lot of the focus going into round one, Richie, against the Jets was, well, the Ducks beat up on the Oilers and the Coyotes. This isn't that great of a team. I mean, they're only 10 points above the Jets. Well, if you think about who their competition was, and maybe they're pressed a little bit more in the Pacific Division, maybe they finished 15 or 18 points ahead of the Jets, and then we're not having this conversation.
Fair point.
So this is a very deep team with a lot of experience. Freddie Anderson, very solid in goal. He doesn't give up a lot. And as you mentioned, you know,
I like Freddie Anderson.
Without Mark Giordano, you know, you're asking Chris Russell and Dennis Wiedemann to go up against the Getzlaff line, or as you mentioned, maybe Brody and Englund get that assignment, but then they have to go up to the Kessler line if they're not up against the Getzlaff and Perry line. And then, you know, you've got a very solid third line going up against whether it's David Schlemko and Ty Weatherspoon. This Ducks team, it's a tough – the problem, too, and the Jets had this problem, how do you score goals when the puck is in your own zone? And this team, it causes a lot of problems on the forecheck. They're a strong, big team. And, you know, it was the same thing. It was like watching game one, Richie, of the Ducks and Flames. It was like watching game four of the Jets and Ducks.
Yeah.
The Ducks were dominant. Yeah, yeah. They didn't miss a step.
And they were physical.
Yeah.
And a Flames team that's not shy, but you lose Furland and then you lose Gaudreau. I mean, they're losing guys. The guys were falling left, right, and center.
You mentioned Kari Ramos starting game two.
He is, yeah. And I want to get to that, Izzy, because the goaltending, we talk about Hiller and wanting to play against the Ducks that let him go. They went through three goaltenders last year.
Anderson. I don't like that decision, by the way.
Well, first off, this. Is Hiller playing against his old team a bigger advantage? Well, I know we've seen game one now. Bigger advantage for the Ducks because they know his weaknesses, or for Hiller because he knows their tendencies? Because, you know, I think personally that's an advantage for the team.
So for
the Ducks.
So the Flames this year, right, they go out and they get Jonas Hiller, and Kari Ramo was good, and even Yoni Ortio at times. You know, the Flames had depth and goal this year. And so they get shell-shocked in game one, 6-1. But to me, the Flames were outplayed in every aspect of the game.
I agree with that.
Right? So to me, you go to Kari Ramo in game two, well, what if he doesn't work out? I mean, to me, you're kind of pulling the trigger there, Bob Hartley, a little bit early. I don't really like the decision.
Every time he's made a decision this year, though, he's been right, basically. I don't disagree with you,
but it's different. The stakes are higher now, though. And again, maybe he's thinking, okay, you know what? If Jonas Hiller, he's lost a little confidence, now is the time to make a move. We talked about it in the first round. You don't want to start screwing around with your goalies in game four and five.
Yeah.
Chicago Blackhawks were forced to do that, though. Scott Darling comes in, he plays really well, but then Scott Darling starts to struggle against Nashville. They have to go back to Corey Crawford. Joel Quenneville was right about that one. Now Corey Crawford obviously won game one versus Minnesota, and the goaltending has really not been where he'd want it to be, but he was forced to make that decision. To me, Hartley's not really forced to make the decision here. I think he's trying to provide a spark to his team. If anything, he's trying to bring in a new goaltender and see how he does, but you know, against this Ducks team, I don't know if the goalie's going to do much.
Yeah, I mean, he's got to be good. He's got to be that good. You wonder if, you know, his strategy is this. Ramo comes in. If he wins, great. If he doesn't, we go back to Hiller for game three at home, and that's our chance, basically.
Yeah, but right? Then, you know, I know the motive behind it. I was a little bit surprised to hear that Kari Ramo was going in that because Hiller didn't play well. Don't get me wrong, and he wasn't spectacular versus Vancouver, but he got you there. He won those games down the stretch to get you into the playoffs, and then he won those games against Vancouver, and now after one game, and a game which you clearly were outplayed again. I mean, the Anaheim Ducks, Getzlaff and Perry, it was like a Getzlaff and Perry skills competition out there.
It was
ridiculous. So, you know, he made the decision, and you know, it's... We'll see what happens. But this Ducks team right now, the way they're playing, I don't think the Flames have a chance.
I don't want to disregard the Flames completely here, but
no, they can win it. They'll win a game Saddledome for sure.
With this next question,
maybe two.
Are you worried if you're a Ducks fan that they're not going to be challenged enough until the third round, and they're not going to be at top level where they maybe could be if they had played a better team here?
No, I don't think so, because I do think the Flames will win a couple games.
Okay.
I mean, that's
well, what, we both how think
I,
Ducks and six.
How I see it playing out. I think that, you know, the Flames, I wouldn't be surprised if they have a pushback here and win a close game tomorrow. They don't play today.
By the way, quickly, the schedule is unbelievable.
I can understand why there's no hockey tonight. You got to think
Why? It's Saturday night.
No, I think they don't want to go up against Mayweather-Pacquiao.
Like, yeah, it's not until 10 o'clock, that fight. Even have a game of four.
But okay. It would be a late game, right, in Anaheim?
Tonight, there's one. Today, there's one game at 12:30. Or is that 11:30?
11:30 Central.
11:30 Central. One game on a Saturday. You know, it's not like you're making all your money off the Canadian TV deal. 11:30. So one game on a Saturday starting at 9:30 on the West Coast.
The only thing that I can think of is that they didn't want to have a game leading up to Mayweather-Pacquiao. I have no idea.
Everyone's going to be getting together anyway.
I agree with you, Richie. Calgary-Anaheim should be playing tonight.
Sunday. I know there's maybe an arena conflict, but move out some other game around. Sunday, 5 o'clock Tampa-Montreal, 7:30 Chicago-Minnesota, and 9 o'clock Calgary-Anaheim. Thank you, NHL, for putting more games on at the same time.
Hey, we don't really know the method to the madness, right? Their madness.
Gary Bettman, I mean, how does he allow for this?
I'll be talking to Gary next week. I'm doing H&L, so I'll have to ask Gary about that.
Gary Lawless or Gary Bettman?
Yeah, no, he's doing the Y dinner.
Yeah, I'm doing the H&L next week, too. When are you on?
Are we doing it together?
I don't think so.
Thursday.
I'm on Friday. With Hustler, right?
Yeah, the Hustler. Mr. Hustler.
Mr. Hustler, sorry. So I just don't understand. So, you know, tomorrow when I try to watch three games at once.
That's tough. You need another TV.
You know, it's not like they have the whole day to put the games on. You need another TV. Exactly. I just don't particularly understand why they do that.
But you know what I mean, though? Isn't that the only thing you can think of? Like the big fight, you don't want to go up against the big fight? Or was there a reason why?
Maybe there's
an event at the Honda Center.
Make somebody play back-to-back then. You don't even have a play one day after Don Cherry was going
on. Maybe Katy Perry's playing at the Honda Center. I don't know.
Oh, going to go that way, eh? Going to go that way. If you grew up like Ezzy and I did with dads who are big hockey fans, you heard about the guy named Denny Potvin a lot in the 1980s with the dominant New York Islanders, one of the best defensemen, if not the best defenseman of his era. Denny Potvin won four consecutive cups with the New York Islanders, now works with the Florida Panthers from Ottawa. We're going to have the Hockey Hall of Famer on after the break to talk about those teams and the National Hockey League playoffs. You're listening to the Legal Curve Hockey Show live on TSN 1290.